House Committee on Schools, Elections, and Public Affairs. June 1st, 1999, hearing room D, 3 p.m.
I'm going to open a public hearing on SCR 12.
You want to brief us on SCR 12, please?
SCR 12. Mr. Chair and committee members, this is about Mr. Dechuri, who was elected to Oregon Senate in 1956 and served four terms. He also built a successful law practice, served as Oregon Transportation Commissioner, Chairman, and on several corporate boards, including U.S. National Bank of Oregon, Union Pacific Railroad, and Equitable Savings and Loan Association. This is in his memory. He died March 23rd, 1999.
Super. Mr. Hazelwood and Mr. Wilhelms, would you like to come in?
I got two other prisoners on me.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Gary Wilhelms. I work in the Senate staff for Senate President Pete Adams. Here today to speak very briefly in support of both Senate concurrent resolutions 12 and 13 when you get through it. I did not have the pleasure to serve with Senator Turi, but I became pretty well acquainted with him shortly thereafter and knew him to be just an absolutely fine gentleman. When we were gathering the information for the resolution, it was very interesting to find some of the facts that are pointed out in the resolution, and I'm not going to go over them all today. You can read those, but suffice to say that he was a great guy. And I think when I called Congressman Smith and asked him for his input, he summarized it pretty well when he said that Tony was a guy that always left you with a smile on your face and a song in your heart. And that, coupled with his prowess as a legislator and the fact that he was the first Basque American to graduate from law school in the United States and also the first Basque American to serve in the legislature in the United States, makes him truly a unique individual. I think he's very worthy of this recognition. Thank you.
Any questions for Mr. Wilhelms?
Okay, thank you, sir. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Lee Hazelwood. I'm legislative coordinator for the Governor's Commission. As the body of SCR 13 mentioned, Harry the Fox Boyven was a member of the Governor's Commission on Senior Services. In addition to his long-remembered service at Oregon Legislative Assembly, the State Board of Education, OLCC, Harry's contribution to the advocacy of seniors were many. He trained countless...
Can I interrupt you just 1 minute?
Yeah.
Actually, on a public hearing on SCR 12.
Sorry.
My mistake in calling you for...
Okay, thank you.
I apologize. Is there anyone else that would like to testify on SCR 12? Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing on SCR 12. We'll open the public hearing on SCR 13.
Can you continue?
No.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I don't believe I'll repeat what I said earlier. I do want to... emphasize that Harry the Fox, I like to call him, a longtime friend of mine. He trained countless seniors in the legislative process, including myself. I wish I had at least a tenth of what I learned from Harry. I've forgotten most of it. He took on the issue of senior housing, worked on legislation regarding continuing care, retirement communities. He worked to protect the rights, resource, income of retired Oregonians. Harry was a leader, an organizer, and a friend to all seniors. His wit and intelligence and candor were valuable contributions to the work of the Governor's Commission. We strongly urge you to pass this resolution to honor Harry Boyven. We know, quote, the Fox would approve, and I think that Harry's looking down. He'd say, Lee, go for it. I learned most of what Harry taught me, and I tried to retain that. He was a great person. You know, any of these 90s were just as sharp as some of us younger people, and probably sharper. So I urge your support.
Thank you. Any questions, Mr. Hazelwood?
Just a couple of points about Harry. Harry Boivin was Speaker of the House in the state of Oregon the year I was born. And it became my pleasure to serve as a state representative from the district in which he lived at the time. And when I'd see him in the coffee shop or wherever down in Klamath Falls, where he used to, he'd always say, you know, I've been President of the Senate twice, but I've only been Speaker of the House once, and I just want you to know, I want you to be on notice, and I'm going to run against you next time so that I can get elected to the House and go back and be Speaker of the House again. and then when it was my pleasure to round up the former Senate presidents for the opening day ceremonies this legislative session, where I got a hold of Harry, who said, well, you know, I'm going to be 95 this Wednesday. And he said, I'd be there, but he said, I've got this little lung infection that the doctor said I got to stay pretty close to home. And we was able to show up. But he was a great guy, and he was one of that coalition of people, both D's and R's, that kind of almost ran the state for probably during the 60s, probably for a decade or more. They were really, truly fine men and fine legislators.
Thank you very much. Questions?
I just noted a wonderful quote that's in this article that we've been presented, where he was once asked by the Associated Press about his most important political lesson, and he replied, tolerance for both parties, don't be bigoted, recognize that each side has their problems and issues.
That's a great
quote.
That's very good. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
We'll close the public hearing. And SDR 12, if we have a quorum, we'll go back to those, both of those resolutions. At this point, I think what we'll do is we will move to Senate Bill 1061 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1061. And committee members, 1061, please.
Committee members, 1061, I will. 1061 has to do with system development charges relating to PERC. It should be at your place in test line. It was back to our office from a Thousand Friends of Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see Mr. Chandler in the audience. He's probably in the hall. He's coming. Mr. Chandler from the Building Industry Association will be here to talk about his bill, we hope.
Thank you. Mr. Chandler, would you wish to address the committee on Senate Bill 1061?
Yes, I remember there is a -A2 amendment.
Yes.
At your place.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. John Chandler here on Senate Bill 1061 and the -2 amendments there too. I have a very written testimony, which is being circulated. A couple things at the outset. I saw a bunch of folks signed up in opposition to the bill, and while I certainly won't make an argument for them, they can do that in due course, I have been asked if this bill is in any way directed at the city of Salem, and the answer is it is not. This is an issue that's been around the legislative hall since 1993, and we have reached an agreement with the cities and counties and special districts this session, but we have been working on this issue for many, many years. I'm not personally aware of whatever is going on in the city of Salem, but just for the record, this is not an exercise in target shooting. The issue we're trying to address here deals with Parks FDC system development charges specifically. In Oregon law, system development charges are available to local governments to pay for water, sewer, streets, parks. With regard to parks, there's been a problem that we've been wrestling with, as I said, for a number of years. In 1991, I believe it was, we filed, and I worked for the Portland Home Builders, a lawsuit against the city of Sherwood on this very issue. The lawsuit was settled before it was ever reported in the appellate reporters. The issue is this. Oregon law allows SVCs for those infrastructure systems that I mentioned. It also provides that system development charges can be spent only on capital capacity increasing infrastructure, capital improvements to respond to the impacts of growth. You cannot use a system development charge, for example, to pay for pothole repair in a highway. You can build a new road with it. You cannot fix what's known in the jargon as pre-existing infrastructure deficits. That's a misuse of the fund. With water and sewer and streets, there rarely is a problem that is being addressed by this bill, but with parks, there often is. And the circumstance is as follows. I'll use the example of the city of Sherwood because we did file a lawsuit on this topic. The city of Sherwood had adopted a parks plan that said for the city they needed X number, I don't recall the specifics now, of park acres per 1,000 residents. They needed X number of ball fields, soccer fields, other facilities per Y number of residents. By their own plan that they had adopted, they didn't have that. They were parks deficient. They were ball field deficient. They were soccer field deficient. Our feeling was and is that when they adopted an SDC based on that higher level of service, so in other words, the new people buying new houses were paying for X number of parks per 1,000, Y number of ball fields per 1,000, and the people living there currently didn't have that available to them, that in a sense they were fixing an infrastructure deficit. The city had identified a lack of parkland, a lack of ball fields, the same way they would identify a pothole in the road, and was using money paid by new residents to essentially prop up the services for existing residents. We didn't believe that was fair. And what we've done over the years are in discussions with the cities and counties, we had essentially the same bill language, or very close to it, agreed to in 1995, and we ran out of session. Last session, we didn't bring it forward because of the impact of ballot measure 50 and the concerns that cities and counties had about infrastructure money generally. This session, what you have in front of you in Senate Bill 1061, is with the, and I'll refer to the dash two amendments, if you don't mind, Mr. Chairman, because that more accurately reflects the agreement we have with local government. And this is probably my candidate for the session's worst sentence here. It's 10 lines without any punctuation, but stylistic issues aside, what it says is the governmental unit shall not establish an FCC for parks based on a level of service facilities greater than the current level of park service within the jurisdiction unless the governmental unit has in place or adopts contemporaneously a plan to create one or more mechanisms to achieve the same level of park service throughout the jurisdiction. In layman's terms, if the jurisdiction has said, we need X number of ball fields, X number of soccer fields, Y number of swimming pools, whatever it might be, and bases a plan on that, that's absolutely fine, they should. But it's unfair to have simply the new people paying for that increased level of service. We think, and the cities have agreed, they should have at that same point some mechanism. They don't have to have the money in the bank. It can be a bond measure. It can be a plan to go out for a referral later. It can have something as long as it's tied to the level of service identified in the plan, and as long as the deck to say it's scheduled for completion within the same time frame as the capital improvement program for parks for the SDC, they should have that in place, some mechanism or mechanisms in place to raise the level of service generally. That's all the bill does. It does not prohibit parks SDCs. It doesn't restrict them. It simply says that if you're going to raise the level of service beyond that which you have for the new residents, you need to have at the same time some way of raising the level of service for the existing residents as well. And I think from a legal standpoint, we settled the Sherwood case. We haven't had occasion to file another one. We are, I think, on good legal grounds where we should do so. There's case law not in Oregon, but in the jurisdictions which stands for this very proposition that impact fees have to reflect the impact of that development, but they cannot be used for that impact plus whatever deficit exists. And in parks, that is where the problem is most striking. The difference between parks and water and sewer and streets is that if we do an upgrade to a water system in a certain section of town, that by definition is going to benefit the people in that section of town. It's very rare if we put in a subdivision that folks from other parts of town are going to come drink the water there. Parks is a little different. Parks are available to the public generally. When a new subdivision is built and parks are built for that subdivision based on SDCs, there is no ability, and there shouldn't be an ability, to exclude existing residents from the use of those facilities. We simply believe there should be a way, though, and this bill provides it, for getting local government up to speed on the existing infrastructure. I think it's a good bill. Local government has agreed to it. Special districts have agreed to it. If you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them, but I certainly ask you to move it on to the floor with a B-pass.
Thank you very much. Questions, Mr. Chandler? Mr. Deck.
So what if you have a town of, say, 250 people, small town, no park, have a plan, we'd like that park someday, and suddenly a big employer comes to town and jobs quadruple and population shoots up dramatically. And they want to assess an SDP to basically provide a park system that is negligible if even existent. How would it work in that sort of scenario?
In that scenario, Mr. Margarbeck, the jurisdiction would be free to adopt whatever level of service they chose and apply an FCC at whatever rate was going to be indicated by the capital improvement plan. All this bill would say is that for those existing 250 folks who live there who would not be paying an FCC, presumably, but would be getting the benefit of the park service, that there would be some mechanism in place to help them pay for their share of that over some period of time. It wouldn't preclude them doing anything.
Does it say that? And does it say that the people behind are going to have, in certain circumstances, does it have language that addresses the notion that people not paying but benefiting, having to pay?
Mr. Chairman, going back to the world's worst sentence here, is what is intended by the language on lines 5 and 6 of the Dash 2 amendment. That has in place or adopt contemporaneously a plan to create one of our mechanisms to achieve the same level of park service throughout the jurisdiction.
Chair, it is a poorly crafted sentence, I agree. Level of service versus paying, being forced to pay for that service can be different kind of concepts that aren't embodied in this language. If your intent is that people who aren't paying for the different SDC but are benefiting by a new park facility, then your intent is that they contribute financially to that, I think you need language that would specifically say that.
I'm sure when I'm going back, I'm certainly open to, with the consent of the local government folks, any language change you might have in mind. I guess on my point, I would point out that I'm not sure how you achieve a level of park service without paying for it. I think it's implicit, but that is something we can certainly take under advisement. Your point we're trying to get at with something like is exactly when we're trying to get at the bill, that the people who are benefiting but not paying ought to pay. Otherwise, you're simply subsidizing that with the new residents, which is perhaps handy for the existing folks, but not particularly fair, and I don't think legal under Oregon law. But, and I will certainly, I don't think the bill doesn't move today, certainly the way it talks is more about possible language changes there to make that more clear.
Okay.
If I may, Mr. Chairman, the reason I'm mentioning the government fees is that we were trying to, an earlier draft of this that could never get reduced to LC, we were trying to address that point without dictating that they had to go out for a bond measure, they had to do something specific that the local government would want to locked into. I don't blame them. I certainly agree with that. But so we adopted language, I think, creates that same concept without coming out and saying you have to have some specific payment mechanism out there. Because I suppose you could hypothesize a non-payment option for land donations or something of the sort.
Thank you, Representative. Do you have any other questions?
Yes. Mr. Chandler, I'd like to get your reaction to one scenario. I'm not saying that I'm in agreement with this, but let's say you do have a city like Sherwood 10, 12 years ago, had a population of about 3,000, had some parklands, had one main community park. The people there probably felt that the park plan that they had was adequate for the population. Now it's about 10,000, just under 10,000. The need for the additional park land, this is the argument that exists in the public, is created by the additional 7,000 people that have moved there. Should the existing residents have to pay for the additional park land under that scenario, since they've already had parkland in space that was adequate for their earlier population.
Somebody should have been able to know. That's what a level of service language is in there. If a jurisdiction has, and I'll use Sherwood as an example, with regard to parkland specifically, and I'm going back a number of years in my memory here, but my recollection is with regard to acreage per thousand residents, there really wasn't a problem. The city had parks in place, and they used essentially that same standard across for the new residents, in which case the new people were paying to get what the old people had. That was fine. The distinction is, in terms of level of service, in the Sherwood case, they identified a need for soccer fields, baseball diamonds, and one or two other things they did not have currently. And that was the issue. They didn't have any baseball fields, and yet they said we needed, and I think it was one per thousand residents, so they would have needed three under the population, and they had none. And so, essentially, the first three that were built with SBCs were going to go for that for 3,000 current residents in a chance, because that was what the city had identified as a need. What this bill would do under that circumstance is that you can have one ball field for 1,000 residents for the new people, but there has to be some way of making sure that the existing residents pay for their own ball fields in a city. That's not how it would work out, obviously, but the ball fields have been holding. But if all you're doing is taking the current level of service and moving it across to the new residents, there's no obligation, there's no problem. And those we don't oppose those fees, we support them typically. If we have a problem where the level of service is at this for existing residents and goes to here for new people.
Second question. You said that local governments at least buy off on this. Does that include the association of Oregon counties, League of Oregon Cities, and special districts?
Representative Mr. Chairman, yes. I'm not sure how they've been doing backflips about it, but they have agreed to the language.
Mr. Chairman, just final. Chairman, I'm not planning to offer any minority report given this relating clause, but it is temporary.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Devlin, I understand that. I'll just count for you to be strong.
Yes.
Well, are you familiar with what Salem has done here with the new park system master plan?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Welsh, no.
Well, there was an interesting email that came that attacked the OBIA and their approach in this bill. That they think is limiting what they can do with the SEC in the city, and exactly what you're describing here. And apparently they went some fairly broad local approach here with the SEC and Salem already.
Thank you. Any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
We're going to close temporarily the public hearing on Senate Bill 1061, and we're going to open the public hearing on Senate Bill 912 to allow two of our colleagues to testify. Senator Tro and Representative Ross, welcome. Please.
Thank you, Representative Starr. I appreciate very much the kindness of the committee. I'm Senator Tro from District 18. I was pleased to introduce Senate Bill 912 and was joined by Representative Ross and Representative Shetterly. And the bill was requested for introduction by the Benton County Commissioners. And basically what they would like to do would be to establish a county service district for human resources. Benton County, I think, more so than many counties, has a very active human resources program. And they think this would be very useful in helping to find a way to fund this program and come up with programs. So, that's why the bill was introduced. It passed on the Senate side with good support, and we're hoping that it will pass on the House side. I understand that Dennis Mulverhill in Washington County is interested in amending the bill to do something there that they very much would like to do. I don't think that weakens the bill at all, and so I think we're friendly to those amendments.
Thank you, Senator. Any questions for Senator Crow?
Could I be excused? I had a committee
absolutely
under what time.
Thank you very much, and I join Senator Coe in thanking you for allowing us to testify because we're both another committee. I do support Senate Bill 912, and it would give our county an opportunity to directly provide a stream of funding for activities that we think are important. And I would like to point out that Benton County has always had a strong focus on prevention, and because we have worked hard on juvenile crime prevention, we have the lowest rate of incarceration of any county in the state, and we also have a very low rate of incidence of juvenile crime. And so it is very likely that we would continue this direct prevention activity. We don't ever think we're done with it. We always think that we're looking for new ways to prevent crime, to focus on youth who might have violent or criminal tendencies of one kind or another, and to provide the family support and direction that is needed to keep these young people out of trouble and to keep our public safe. And so with that, I would urge you to support this bill, and also we have no objection to the amendments brought forward by Washington County. So thank you very much. I'll be glad to respond to questions. Our commissioner, Linda McGrell, who was promoting this, was not able to be here today, and so I would like for us to, I apologize for her absence and want to speak for her.
Can you tell me what the concerns were in the Senate General Government Committee on this? Did they have testimony from any particular entity that they thought this was problematic?
I don't think there was any adverse testimony in the committee. I was not there, but I understand it was a very strong presentation, and my impression was from the reports that I got that it was positive. I did not hear of any adverse testimony.
Any further questions, Representative Ross? Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you all very much. I appreciate it.
And we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 912. We will come back to that. And Representative Shetterly is available. And we will reopen the public hearing on Senate Bill 1061. Actually, do we have a point?
Yes.
Close the hearing on Senate Bill 1061. We're going to go into work session on the two resolutions. Yeah, and get the resolutions. We'll open the work session on SDR 12.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Mr. Beck.
I move approval of SDR 12 with a due pass recommendation to the floor.
We have a motion on the floor. Any comments, questions? Any objections? Seeing none. So approved. Close the work session on SCR 12. Open the work session on SCR 13.
Mr. Chair, move SCR 13 to floor to do pass recommendation.
Have a motion on the floor. Any comments, questions? Any objections? Seeing none, so approved. We'll close it.
Okay.
We'll,
chairs, vote closed.
Who would any volunteers to carry in SCR 12?
I wonder if Representative Butler, I think Mr. Turi was from that part of the world.
That part of it, mm-hmm.
Maybe we'll find out to Representative Butler.
We will check with Representative Butler.
Mm-hmm.
Any volunteers for FTR 15, Mr. Bovine?
Bovine. Perhaps
Representative Atkinson? You wish to carry that?
Certainly, if Representative Harper doesn't want it.
Okay, we'll check with Representative Harper. If not, that's the next. Okay. Close work session on SCR 13. And we will reopen the public hearing on 1061. Thank you for your flexibility, committee. We will call Lindy Kroger, Betsy Belshaw, and David Eugen. Testifying 1061. Thank you. If you'd identify yourself for the record, please.
Good afternoon. My name is Wendy Kroger, and I live in Salem. I want to thank you for the opportunity today to testify on Senate Bill 1061A. Frankly, I'm sorry I have to be here on this matter. I'm a volunteer for my city, and I spend my time working on positive solutions to problems rather than trying to stick my finger in dikes, and that's what I kind of think this is. I believe that Senate Bill 1061 serves very narrow interests to the detriment of Oregon cities and towns in general, and I wanted to let you know that I served as the chair of the citywide, that Salem citywide Parks Advisory Committee, which oversaw the development of Salem's first park system master plan in over 20 years. In my view, there are three specific concerns which require that this bill go no further. First, this is a local control issue, I believe. This is not a state-level issue. Surely the legislature doesn't see it the state's role to be setting and modifying annual SDC levels or day-to-day running of SDC mechanisms in all the cities of Oregon. How cities finance their parks is an issue that I believe should be determined locally. Second, we already have mechanisms to address parks equity in Salem. First, we've passed our capital improvement plan and passed it by the city council. Secondly, we do have a park system master plan, which has already been passed by the city council after review and hearings by the city council, the planning commission, and the Salem Parks and Recreation Board, plus multiple community and public forums. Third, we have a city self-imposed bond tax, under which a general obligation bond in the amount of over $77 million for parks will be proposed in FY 2002 to go before the voters to work with deficit parks. Fourth, we have parks SDCs in the plan for growth-related parks, which are scheduled for public hearings this month before the city council. And fifth, we have a city revenue task force, which will be identifying and recommending additional sources of revenue to the city's general fund, in part to pay for operations and maintenance for current and future parks in Salem. Third, we believe that the real disaster this bill will visit on Salem and most other cities and towns in Oregon will not be immediate. Salem's new parks master plan identifies 8 classifications of parks in Salem. However, it identifies levels of service for just 3 of those classifications. Funding strategies are attached only to those 3 levels of service. The result, we believe, if this bill passes, is that SDCs would be used only for those parks to which levels of service have already been attached. So in Salem, SDCs could never be used to pay for growth-related parks in such classifications as natural resource, preservation or conservation areas, special use facilities such as aquatic centers, historic sites, and connector trail systems. Other Oregon cities and towns which have not yet identified levels of service for their parks will be precluded from using SDCs for growth-related parks. We think our master plan is modest in the levels of service that it calls for, but it probably is unique in terms of the depth, comprehensiveness, and specificity of the financial strategies that it proposes to implement its different components. It sets specific citywide levels of service based on population. It identifies general obligation bond funding for deficit parks which must be created to meet current population needs, SDCs specifically for growth-related parks, and it determines the amount and timing of funding needed to maintain current parks as well as new ones as they come online. Full implementation of the plan adopted after 18 months of intense citizen effort and input remedies the current deficit and avoids future ones. It does that by going to the voters to fund deficit parks, charging SDCs for future parks at levels necessary to see that growth pays for itself, no more, no less, and it finds a stable funding source through its general fund for park maintenance. If the city is not allowed to implement this park's master plan, the deficit will grow ever larger and growth will not pay for itself. As residential densities increase in Salem, pressure on the UGB will intensify. Without cities and parks and open space to alleviate that population pressure, we believe the UGB will be breached sooner rather than later. Current levels of service in Salem are well below those of many other Northwest cities. Many Northwest cities have 10 to 20 park acres per 1,000 population. Salem set a modest 8 acres per 1,000 in the current levels of service in the master plan. We currently have only 5.6 acres per 1,000 residents, but we've added 32,000 people in the last 14 years and built almost no new parks in that period. If we're held to this current level, we'll never catch up to the needs for even minimal levels of service. So I urge that you vote no pass on this bill and let local citizens address this issue equitably. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Mr. Carter?
Mrs. Belshaw.
My name is Betsy Belshaw. I also live in Salem, and I'm vice president of the Salem Parks and Recreation Advisory Board. You know, listening to Mr. Chandler's testimony, it seems that his big problem is whether SDCs are going to be used for deficit park development. At least that's the way I read it. I have to say, everybody on the Parks Board and everybody in the Parks Department, none of us read this that way. If that's what he's worried about, then I think we ought to address that issue only. I think the law is that SDCs are not to be used for deficits at the present time, and therefore I don't see any need for this. But the thing that disturbs me most is I don't read this the way he does at all. And this does have a specific impact on Salem. He said it's not a target shoot, but the timing is just perfect for trying to destroy our parks plan. And this is really a big problem for the city of Salem.
Thank you. Any questions, Mr.
Chair?
Yes, Captain Beck.
Well, I'm curious, just kind of for the record, you are on a parks advisory committee, so you've have more understanding of this than most of us up here. Well, I guess I'm not really sure what this says. It's also convoluted.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You guys work on it. What does level of service mean in this context? Create one or more mechanisms. What kind of mechanisms are we talking about here? Am I missing something, or do you people do this as volunteers, but you're actively involved, clearly. You work with your parks director, and he or she tells you how you can finance parks.
Well, the committee put together the Salem Master Parks Plan, and in the parks plan, they developed a level of service. Right now, it's at 5.6. I think we're trying to move it up because of the growing size of our city. That was developed by the, not by our Parks Department, but by the citizen committee. In addition to that, they put together a funding mechanism, which is based upon revenues that we get from the city monies, the FDCs, and the bond issue in 2002. So we have a three-pronged tool right now to support our master parks plan. The way we read this, and I have the same problem you have with it, because none of us who read this got the same thing out of this that Mr. Chandler did. And if Mr. Chandler is only worried about SDCs not being used for deficits, we don't have any problem with that because that's the law. But I don't get that.
Worry about other things.
That's what worries me. I just don't get that out of this, and I'm not sure what this means or where it's going to go, but the way we read it is it undercut our parks plan that we worked so hard on, which we think is a local issue. We're not quite sure why they're taking flash shots at our parks plan, even though he says he never heard of our parks plan.
Thank you very much. Mr. Eugen?
Yeah, my name is Dave Engen. I live in Salem, and I'm also... Okay. Is this okay?
Yes.
Yeah, my name is Dave Engen, and I also live in Salem, and I'm also on the Parks and Recreation Advisory Board for Salem. One of the problems that I have with this 1061 is that it was introduced right at the very time that Salem was trying to establish this new plan to upgrade the level of service for the citizens of Salem. And it's important to realize that no new parks in new growth areas of the city, let me rephrase it. It's important to realize that the new parks in the new growth areas of the city were going to be paid for by SDCs, and SDCs were not going to pay for other parks in other areas of the city which had other funding mechanisms. However, the funding mechanisms which would pay for upgrading the rest of the city's parks, not the new ones, was dependent upon a bond issue coming up in the year 2002. Now, if this passes, I can see challenges to the SDCs that Salem was going to try to pass to buy the new parks, because it's going to be 2 years before we can pass these new measures to finance the older parks of the city, parks for the older parks of the city. And that's basically the way I interpret this bill. It says that if the LOS in all parts of the city are not raised at the same time that they are in the new parts of the city, you can't do it. So you can't have the SDCs to do that. And if that does delay buying the land for parts of the new parts of the city, it is going to cost so much more to buy that new land that it's basically going to shoot down the parks plan. And that is one of the things that the people from the building industry came into City Hall to complain about, was the cost of land for the new parks in the city. Now, so they're putting the city in a squeeze. You can't have the SDCs, and if you can't have the SDCs to buy the new land, it's going to cost a heck of a lot in the future to buy the land after we pass these bond issues. So it's really, this is a bad bill, and please realize that this is important for the city of Salem not to have this passed. And I thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you, Mr. Hingen. Do you think Tracy has a question?
Mostly just a comment for us is that I think it would be good to get legislative counsel to give us some kind of interpretation of what this actually says.
Any other questions for these witnesses? Thank you very much for taking time today. Call Mr. Delk and Mr. Spolsky. Introduce yourself to the record.
Yes, I'm Larry Delk. I'm also in Salem here, a resident, although I'm not on any of the committees that these folks are on. I guess I basically am here just supporting them, and most of the things they've said that I objected to have already been said. Representative Beck was asking about certain scenarios, and I guess one of the scenarios that came to my mind was if my son and daughter, although they live in Sacramento, just moved into a new home in a new area, and they were happy about the new parks and new schools and all the things that were in the area that they could enjoy. And it seems to me, depending on how you read this bill, which I guess you can read it many different ways, but depending on how you read it, it might prevent people in new housing areas from having the parks and the things that they should have in their area and that the rest of the city would like to have until the rest of the city can figure out some solution to the lesser park levels that they have. And it seems to me that they're two separate problems. And fairness and the direction that these are being used for is already addressed in the law, and therefore it doesn't seem like you should limit developing new parks at proper levels simply because you're having difficulty under the tax measures now in place to correct the current situation. They should be worked on separately. Anyhow, that's basically all I have to add to that.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Mr. Dove? Go ahead.
I'm Dan Sophie. I'm on the Parks Board. I'm a local dentist. And a couple of things that Mr. Chandler addressed that I just want to try to help understand a little better. If an area, if the new rules or the parks plan says, or the new city plan says, new areas will have sidewalks, and the old areas don't, and the new areas have to pay for their own sidewalks, that's kind of what we're talking about in the park business. There, 20 years ago, in Kibbutz and the Sherwood situation, a lot of girls didn't play soccer. Nobody played soccer, maybe. Not a group, a lot of girls played baseball or softball. Now we've got a whole different situation. The city's goal is to have so many ball fields per 1,000, or however they measure it. The new areas, land, facilities, things should be set aside. Salem just bought 4 acres behind Toys R Us over on Lancaster for $100,000 an acre. $400,000 for a 4-acre park that's only half as big as you need to have a neighborhood park or some story like that. Backfilling, it should have been purchased or laid out or set aside years ago, when it was cheap and it could have been responsible. This is what we're trying to do with our master plan, and we're trying to have people who are in the area help, who are going to benefit, pay for it. I would recommend that this not be passed. I don't quite understand it, but I think that it's a local issue, and it's the state micromanaging it. You guys do a lot of other things, don't you? I mean, there are bigger issues out there than how neighborhoods thunder parks. That's pretty much my comment.
Thank you, Mr. Soci. Any questions, Mr. Soci? Person back.
Mr. Soci, I'm just curious, again, you seem like a civic minded soul, and still on the Parks Commission. Just on line 3, do you have the amendment there?
Yes, I do.
Line 3, government units shall establish a system development charge for parks that is based upon a level of service for facilities that is greater than the current level of park service. Do you think that means the current level of park service that is existing, or the current level that the community would like some day in the future, or is that unclear?
One of the things that we have in Salem is that there's supposed to be a neighborhood park within a half a mile walk of every residence. Well, there are some areas that don't have that, and we've spent like this $400,000 4-acre park in Toys R Us. We're backfilling it, and we hope that, I don't know if that's a rule or that's a level of service that we're aspiring to, let's say. And that's the level of service that we'd have to expect the new area to the new residents, the new development to be equal to. So we only have one swimming pool in this town. The future is, the future, our goal is to have more than that. And if they were to, I think that we have a plan, a strategic plan to get there and to lock out that image of a suburban neighborhood without sidewalks, just because downtown didn't have sidewalks, that's wrong. Sidewalks are important now. They're part of the thing. Things are different than they used to be. Locking it into what it used to be or what people did in the past is inappropriate.
So,
your question was...
Well, I think I just want to clarify. What you're saying is that you would read this or you would interpret this, even though it's very convoluted, I understand, the level of service that is desired by the community versus the existing level of service. This would allow SDCs to be levied only or to the extent they provide a level of service that is planned for, desired,
I would suspect
by the community.
That's just the weakest link out there. You know, they would go to an area that might not have sidewalks and said, look, downtown doesn't have sidewalks. We don't need to have sidewalks out there. You don't have parks downtown. One of the other things that we, in our master plan, we didn't look at this half acre or one half a mile walking area. We didn't take into account multi-family dwellings, apartment houses.
Okay.
Oops.
Right.
The G.I. Joe's is surrounded by apartment houses, if this weren't. And so we're constantly evolving what the goal is. And to lock it into something just doesn't seem appropriate.
Right.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your time today. Lynn McNamara and Dave Honeycutt. And colleagues, Joe Barkowski from the City Council is here. He'll talk about the amendment structure of these businesses. Maybe clarify them.
Mr. Chair. Lynn McNamara from the League of Oregon Cities. Mr. Chandler is correct that the bill and the amendments that you see represent a compromise that we reached. Did we think we needed this at all in the first place? No. Did we come to a compromise? Yes. And particularly with the amendments, we were particularly concerned that the language in 1061, as it passed from the Senate, appeared that a city would have to have the money in the bank, and that was not something that we think is acceptable. I will say the City of Salem had not contacted us about their concerns about this bill. We believe it to mean that an SDC that's established, if it is going to be for a level of service, number of tennis courts per 1,000 people, number of acres per 1,000 people, as the Salem representatives were talking about, it either would match the current level of service or the city would adopt one or more mechanisms, meaning planning to have a bond issue or including it in their master plan to have the level of service for existing residents brought up to that new standard. It was very important to us, again, that it not be requiring the city to do it
at a moment's notice. Most cities didn't want to. But we do buy the concept of not having SDCs do deficit parks funding. So that's what we tried to achieve with this. We think if you are going to pass this bill, and we would not be heartbroken if you did not, the amendments are important to make it clear, and maybe you can make it clear, that a city would be adopting a plan as opposed to actually having to do it at the same time as not to be SDC.
Thank you. I have a question. Do you see this amendment, with that A2 amendment, in conflict with what the city plan is doing presently?
Mr. Chairman, it's not 100% clear to me. As I was listening to Edgar, I'm not familiar with their actual actions as the process had gone through. As they were describing it, it sounded to me as if they were doing something that this would call on them to do. As I understand it, and maybe Mr. Honeycutt will contradict me if he does, and I have a bigger concern, that not that they plan to have a bond issue, and that's it, the plan. They can't guarantee that it's going to pass. They've included in their master plan. We would be very concerned if it were not the case that Salem was doing everything that it should be doing under this amendment.
Okay, thank you. Any further questions, Mr. Deck?
I just want to clarify this level of service business. If you're a city that has a desired level of service that you have not yet achieved for any number of reasons, and you are a big city, small city, whatever, and suddenly you have a new bunch of residents and you'd like to charge an SDC, which will allow at least those areas of town to, or the city, help the city as a whole achieve the long desired plan, whatever, level of service. It seems to me that should be the goal. It's not clear to me that this amendment accomplishes that. I mean, this sets the bar for level of service potentially very low, even though they're made the community, an evolving community, may have had desires and goals that they haven't been able to achieve yet. And now growth is becoming, they need to be able to assess that growth to reach that level, desired level of service.
Mr. Chair, Representative Beck, as I understand it, let's say you have a group of new residents coming in, you're adopting an SDC that would require 8 tennis courts per 2,000 people. And that's your overall goal. What I understand this to say is that that city, if it's adopting 8 tennis courts for 2,000 people, would also have to have, as part of its plan, a way to get to 8 tennis courts per 2,000 people for the rest of the community. And not to stop them from having it initially with the SDC, but just to have a plan to get there and a reasonable approach.
So this is important, if I can, Mr. Chair. So if you, on your example, the new development will be assessed to provide the 8 tennis courts for 2,000 people. The rest of the city that has never been able to afford that, for whatever reasons, all they would need under this bill is to have a piece of paper that says, this is our goal. Someday we hope to be able to assess ourselves through a ballot measure or our own little fee to get there, but we aren't required to get there. But the new development would be required to achieve that desired level of service. That's correct? Am I being clear?
Chair, Representative Beck, my understanding is in a capital improvement plan, there are you have to include how you would fund your project. And so if you were including that in your park master plan, you would have some way to fund those projects as well. I think that it's more than a promise, but less than money in the bank. Mm-hmm.
This is very vague.
President Devlin has a question.
Yeah. If we took this bill away, and we're just talking about current law on SDCs, and obviously SDCs are governed by state law, and you had a city in which they, let's say, had one level of park service, and that could be a wide variety of different things, but they desired a higher level of park service. Say, for instance, given the example that was previously given, maybe they only had two soccer fields, which becomes quite evident that they need more, or that they need more tennis courts, or something else. Wouldn't the current law, to some degree, help you determine how you would apportion those costs between existing residents, and how you would apportion those costs to new development?
Mm-hmm. And Mr. Chair, Representative Devlin, one of the reasons that at least some of the cities that we've discussed this with are not particularly concerned about it is that they believe current law covers this. I believe proponents of the bill saw it differently and have had this, an example that they've used, but I believe most cities believe that this is how you do it now.
Second question. When the league comes in here and testifies, or the association of Orange County, have you had your counsel read these to see how they could potentially be interpreted? Obviously, we have a probably one of the longest sentences in Oregon statutes mm-hmm. being proposed. How it could potentially be interpreted?
Mr. Chair, Representative Devlin, the league's counsel has not looked at the city of Portland bid and believes that that's what it said.
Okay. Thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you very much. Mr. Honeycutt?
Thank you, Chair Starr, members of the committee. Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action, speaking in support of the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 1061. I think there are a couple of questions from both Representative Peck and Representative Devlin that we can, I'd like to try and clear up if I could. This bill doesn't set a level of service. The local governments are free to set the level of service for whatever level of service they want for their parks or their ball fields or for their swimming pools or tennis courts or what have you, and this bill doesn't have any effect on that level of service. Now, the level of service would be controlled by both their methodology by things such as the Dolan case, but obviously this bill doesn't have any relationship with that. What this bill does do is simply apportion the payment for the increased level of service amongst the existing residents and the new residents. And it attempts to make sure that the existing residents, if we're increasing level of service, are going to pay a share for that increase that's proportionate to what you would charge the folks that are moving in. A matter of fairness that your new folks don't pay any more for moving into town for if you're wanting to increase the level of service than the folks that are already there. The second thing, the point that needs to be made, this bill, even if it passes, will not prohibit a city from using FDCs to increase the level of service. There was testimony earlier that a local jurisdiction would not be able to increase their level of service. That's not the case. You can still use FCCs to increase the level of service. And it sounds to me from the testimony that we have from the folks in Salem that they would comply with this provision if it was in effect at the current time. So I'm not sure that some of it appears that there's a misunderstanding from the committee as to the effect of it. So I would also encourage the committee to take a look at the language after the first four lines. If you look at the first, or actually lines 2, 3, and 4, I think Representative Beck made a good point. It appears upon reading lines 2, 3, and 4, essentially that the local government can't use FCCs to increase the level of service. I agree that's what it says when you read the first three lines, but then you need to go to line 5 where it says, unless the governmental unit has in place or adopts contemporaneously with the FCC a plan to create one or more mechanisms to achieve the same level of park service throughout the jurisdiction. But what the amendments say is you can go ahead and increase level of service provided that you apportion the increase equitably and equally amongst the existing residents and the new residents. All we're trying to do is make sure that the new folks in town don't pay for increased level of service that the existing folks want but are unwilling to pay for it. And my experience that when there is a when there's something that's free, there's an unlimited demand for that, and so all we're trying to do is make sure that everybody pays an equal share. And I think that's the dash two amendments make that clear, and we certainly support them.
When I look at this on lines 7 and 8, I see the potential of there being, let's say, an existing park, a new park in the same jurisdiction, and the language saying you have to achieve the same level throughout the jurisdiction. You understand what I'm saying? As opposed to the people that the people who were there previously having to pay their fair share. Makes sense to you?
Chair Sauer, Representative Piercy, I'm having
trouble priming. Okay. Well, maybe I'm looking at this the wrong way, but I'm just saying a jurisdiction, a city, having some old parks that operate at one level, putting in a new park at a new level, and then this language somehow saying that everything has to be at the same level.
Chair Starr, Representative Piercy, that I don't believe that's what the amendments say. That they don't, they're not requiring an increased level of service again. It doesn't. This bill doesn't have any effect on the level of service. It's simply it's apportioning the payments between new residents and existing residents.
I understand that's what you want to say. I'm not convinced it's so.
Ms. Honeycutt, on line 6, this notion of a plan. I don't understand, maybe there's guidance elsewhere in statute about what a plan to create one or more mechanisms. Is that a piece of paper that says, it is our desire as a city council to help the old part of town achieve a certain level? That's our goal. A lot of plans are ideas on papers, as I understand, we don't necessarily happen for 5, 10, 20 years, and sometimes plans get changed because people's values change. That's very vague to me to respond to that. But then also, I think what Representative Piercy was getting at, this plan is sort of, the plan has to be completed, or is an implication, the plan has to be completed by a certain time, not later than the estimated time for completion of the capital improvement program in the new part of town. Well, they're going gangbusters, and they're getting their new tennis courts, one tennis court per 10,000 people, but the rest of the town has never had that. They've always wanted to, but it's going to take them 10 years to get a ballot measure passed to reach that level of service they've always wanted, and it's prescribed in their plan. It seems to me they're you sort of negate the new FTC charge. You can't be prohibited from charging that rate, I guess. I don't know. This is very confusing.
President Beck, I think Joe Barkowski from Legislative Council is here, and he drafted his amendment. If he would come up and maybe shed just a little brief light on how this is worded and why it was worded the way it was, it could be worded this way.
Joe Fairstar, I might also suggest, and I'll defer the second answer, the answer to the second question the representative posed to Mr. Chandler. To answer the first question, I think the representative from the Labor Board and Cities answered that correctly. The plan is something more than a promise. It would be contained in the capital improvement program plan. It would be more than a promise, but less than the money is. I think that was that's about as well put. I think you can make it.
Mm-hmm. Still pretty vague.
Representative Piercy has a question for Joe.
Hi. Thanks. I think you've heard my question really is, when you interpret this for us, tell us exactly what this language says to you.
Yeah,
Members of the committee, my name is Bill Warakowski. I'm with the Office of Legislative Counsel. I prepared these A2 amendments. And, the reason they read as they do is because the language was requested by the proponents of the amendments, and as someone earlier testified, they were the result of a compromise, which doesn't always result in the purpose of the language. As to what they mean, the governmental unit shall not establish a system development charge that's based on a level of service for a facility greater than the current level of park service within the jurisdiction. Well, however you define level of service, you have to look at the proposed level of service for the development, the level of service that exists now throughout the entire jurisdiction. And if the level of service proposed is higher than that general level of service throughout the entire jurisdiction, then you can't impose the system development charge unless the governmental unit has in place or adopts contemporaneously with the system development charge a plan to create mechanisms to elevate the general level of service throughout the entire jurisdiction. And that, it seems to me, is what the amendments call for. The plan has to provide for that general level of service, increased level of service throughout the entire jurisdiction, within a time frame that's the same as the proposed completion of the development, which may leave the city with a governmental unit with a relatively short time in which to come up with this plan and
not at all. All right, let me understand this. So let's say you have to have so many ballparks per 1,000 residents, and you have a new park going in, and you are changing. Is it possible for you to change the level of service for one part of a jurisdiction and not have another part of that jurisdiction be able to achieve that service? So let's say in one part you had, I don't know, two ballparks per 1,000 residents in your new part and your old part is one ballpark per. Does that mean you have to go back and change that level of service to all those other parks in that jurisdiction?
I believe so, Representative Kirstie. If you're talking about ballparks, this amendment assumes that you're going to be able to say for a particular development, you can determine the level of service.
Mm-hmm.
You then look at the level of service throughout the entire jurisdiction,
mm-hmm.
including this new development.
Mm-hmm.
And
then you would be required to provide that same level of service to all the other places in the community.
Well, within the governmental unit, yeah.
So it's different than saying, if I may...
Please.
That's different than saying we want both old and new people to pay for this new park, the level of service in a new park within the jurisdiction.
Well, I think that if you're talking about who pays for the increased level of service throughout the rest of the jurisdiction, I think that is going to be determined by the plan and the mechanisms that are required. The amendments are not all that specific with regard to what the plan and what the mechanisms are. That'll be left up to the governmental unit. But presumably, the mechanisms will require payment either by the general populace in the governmental unit or by the people outside this new development. So that's where you get the payment by both newcomers and the existing people. It's quite clear that when the amendments talk about a plan and mechanisms, there are no specifics there. The only requirement is that there be a plan, that it have provide for mechanisms by which the level of service can be increased throughout the rest of the jurisdiction, and that it be done by a certain time. which is the same time as the completion of the new development.
I'd like to move along. We're just trying to cut as a last witness, and we do have two other bills that I can move on with. And Representative Settle is patiently waiting for us to move on to another bill. Mr. Honeycutt, do you have some brief closing comments?
Would you like to make a question that first our question that Representative Christine raises? Quite frank, I don't know the answer to that. I don't know.
Perhaps we could, in the next couple of days, clarify these issues, and then we'll, when this comes back,
okay.
We'll be able to deal with that. I can move on at this point, though, if you can. So thank you. Well, thank you, Mr. Parkoff. We're close to public hearing on Senate Bill 1061. We'll open the public hearing on Senate Bill 912. Representative Shetterly, thank you very much for your patience. Appreciate that.
Thank you for your accommodation. For the record, Lane Shetterly, State Representative District 34. Chair, members of the committee, I think you've already heard some testimony from Senator Crow and Representative Ross on this bill. Senate Bill 912, I'm having, through the courtesy of committee staff, distributed to you a letter from the Benton County Board of Commissioners, and I think apart from just being here to say that I am in support of the bill and the request for favorable consideration, my other purpose today, I think, is to make sure that the commissioner's letter gets in the record, that they accurately describe the bill as a means of adding a tool to the toolbox that counties may have at their disposal to deal with human services needs within local counties. And to that end, I think it's an acknowledgement in favor of local control, giving counties an opportunity to establish these local services districts for human services to address local needs at the approval of their local voters. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions, or I'll...
Any questions? Representative Shetterly? Representative Shetterly, do you have any opposition or concern about the amendments proposed from Washington County?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. No opposition. My only concern, obviously, is that the amendments not slow the bill down. It's one of those where I'm friendly to them as long as they're friendly to the bill.
Thank you very much. And thank you for your patience today.
Yes, thank you again.
Mr. Mobihill.
Good afternoon. Dennis Mobihill from Washington County Government Affairs. First of all, Washington County Board of Commissioners is also Board of Directors for the Unified Sewerage Agency, so I represent both bodies. This is the same one depending on which day you're down here. The Board of Directors and the Board of County Commissioners support Senate Bill 912 as written, and we also have some amendments to it, which you should have before you, and you should have my testimony there, which I had at some place at the bottom of your file. What our amendments do, simply put, is that they create allow a water resource management district to be formed, a special district to be formed. It accomplishes two things. One is it will help protect the Unified Sewerage Agency, which is the county service district, from the unintended consequences of a ballot measure that has been certified and is out being signatures being collected on it now. And at the same time, it'll allow counties to more effectively address the endangered species listings that were just starting to cope with up in the Tri-County area. So first, let me talk about the Unified Sewerage Agency problem. Mr. Bill Sizemore has an amendment to an initiative to abolish Metro. And the way he's constructed it, it will also pick up and hook in the Unified Sewerage Agency. And he does this in a couple of ways. One is that he defines regional government to be any government entity that provides more than one service to more than one city or county. And if you look at the Unified Sewerage Agency, they provide a sewerage and surface water management services to several cities in the county, so we're picked up there. And then in the latter part of the his initiative, he tries to give some exclusions, but he neglected to put in a district that provides sewerage and surface water management services, so we get good in both places. I should say here that Mr. Sizemore is aware of our concerns on this one, but by the time we caught up with it, his initiative has already been certified by the courts, and he said he wasn't particularly interested in having to go back through that process again. So I'm down here saying. So the changes, what we would do, simply put, is that we'd create a new general heading for a county service district, water resource management. It would provide a variety of water-related services. And number two, and this is the part that we tried to keep it very narrow, is that it would allow a county to abolish an existing district that's providing two or more water-related services without a public vote, only if it is reformed into a water resource management district and no new operating taxes are required. So the reason that's in there is that under current law, if a county wants to abolish a district, you have to take it out for a vote. And if you want to have permanent tax rate, you got to take it out for a vote. But we're arguing that since we've already got an entity and we're just going to reform it into something else and nothing else changes other than the title, then we should do it on a voice vote of the committee. Let me close with just saying that what we're recognizing with the Endangered Species Act listing is going to take an unprecedented amount of coordination and integration of efforts. And we would argue that a water resource management district would actually provide a way for the Unified Sewerage Agency and the county itself to address those needs without having to create another government agency. So we'd ask your support of SB 912 with dash one amendment.
Mr. Moyo, your question here for that is
a technical one. But I have some writing on them. I assume that's your writing.
That's correct. Thank you for on the first page of 912-1 at the top, where I changed the line 4, O to P. The way they were drafted, it would have been a, truly put, it would have been a, I got the stuff, and it wasn't meant to be that, it's supposed to be just the stuff. So you've got to have that in there, or this isn't, it wouldn't get at what we want to do. It was meant to be a friendly, as Representative Shutterly asked for, very friendly.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Thank you. Anyone else wish to testify on Senate 912? No one. We will close public hearing on Senate 912. This bill, Alex, is on a schedule for later this week, and at that point we will further address this bill. It's already been scheduled.
Mr. Chairman, we will get some minor corrections, but we'll not so that there can be an LC form for the next meeting.
Yes, staff is kissing their heads, so I think that would be taken care of. At this point, we will open a public hearing on House 2830. Mr. Moore will talk briefly about the Dash 5 Amendment, 2830.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 2830, there is a Dash 5 amendment in your pack, and Dash 5 is the corrections that are brought out of the other amendments for this bill and also restored some original language that was in RF 654-0721 in Section 4 of the amendment. And this replaces any public amendments for this bill.
Thank you very much. We will call for Mr. DeLuca and Mr. Witt. Testifying the bill. Please identify yourself as the speaker. And if, in light of our time, if you could be as brief as possible, we have quite a sign-up sheet to be helpful for the committee members. And if you have written testimony, please submit that. Go right ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Peter DeLuca. I am the administrator of Oregon OSHA. I will be as brief as I can be. I've covered much of what I wanted to say in my written testimony. There are some points that I think I need to make because some of this bill contains provisions that I think would be favorable for our program. We have big concerns about other portions of this bill, and I think that in your deliberations with respect to what to do with this bill, you need to hear the whole story from our perspective and make up your own mind there. I am, in addition to being the administrator of Oregon OSHA, also an attorney. Although I am in a period of recovery, I have been since 1994. During my previous practice, I practiced with the Department of Justice. I was the attorney in charge of labor law. Prior to that, I worked for a union, OPEU. So I've had about 25 years in the area of worker issues, and that's the experience that I bring to bear today as I testify. Oregon OSHA, many of you know, and some of you may not know, is a program which has really come a long way. In the past 10 or so years, we've had a 30% reduction in the rates of injuries and illnesses in the workplace. In 1989, Oregon was the fourth highest state in the union in workers' compensation rates. Today, I'm pleased to report to you the most recent survey shows us at number 38, from 4th to 38. That's a great record. That is a great record. How did we do it? We got here in part by inspections of the worst first, which is a concept which this bill would codify, but we did not get here on the basis of inspecting the worst only. We have had over the years a system of random inspections which go to all businesses in the state of Oregon and which take our inspectors into all businesses in the state of Oregon. And while we have attempted to concentrate our efforts in those areas where the worst violations of the act may occur or the worst injury and illness histories in workplaces may occur, we also inspect in other areas as well. We believe that this incorporates a system of both prevention and cure. And as you are well familiar with the old adage, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. The cure is when we go to the worst workplaces. And the prevention is when we go to other workplaces and we try to work with employers when we're in those workplaces and help them to make their workplaces safer. And we also have a number of other preventative measures that we use, one of which is consultation. We have 40 consultants in our division which do nothing but consultation whenever a business invites them to assist the business with making the workplace safer. So we do a number of things which are preventative, and we also do some things which are curative. To the House bill, and I have seen the Dash 5 amendments, I've seen the Dash 4 amendments. While there are subtle differences, they're all fairly similar, and I'm just going to address them generally rather than going strictly by the Dash 5 amendments. One of the things that we find in here is, at least as I read it, is more directed toward worst only instead of worst first. It directs us to inspect only the worst small businesses, only the worst large businesses, and if we go beyond that to any kind of a random list, then we would only inspect those businesses which have a workplace history which places them in the worst 50% of their respective standard industrial code rating. This would mean that we would not inspect businesses unless they've already injured workers. We would only go there if they've injured workers. And this departs from the preventative aspect that we have typically employed over the years. A concern that we have in one of these sections is the word ordinarily. And I can tell you, as a lawyer, the reason I have this concern is because it seems to me that a creative lawyer seeking to avoid a penalty in a workplace where we hadn't necessarily been to the worst first would say, well, it says ordinarily you go to the worst first, then this must have been an extraordinary circumstance. And I think then it would be incumbent upon us to prove some kind of an extraordinary circumstance which brought us into this workplace in order to be able to inspect it. And we see this as at least potentially restricting us quite a bit, in spite of testimony that I've heard in other committee meetings on this bill that the concept would allow great latitude on the part of the administrator of Oregon OSHA to go anywhere that the agency wanted to go. I think this is very restrictive language. Another section in this particular bill and with these amendments talks about inspection, random inspection only in areas where the worst or where the lost workday case incidence rate is above the national average. It says to the extent allowed under the Occupational Safety and Health Act and under federal regulations adopted, et cetera, et cetera. I've read this section about five times. I've spoken with my counsel at the Department of Justice as to the meaning of this section, and frankly, both of us are baffled as to what this section means. I have spoken with at least one of the authors of the section. It kind of looks to me like it maybe is a joint effort. Somebody wrote one sentence, and somebody wrote another sentence, and maybe we have a third person writing yet a third sentence. But I think I understand what the intent of that language to the extent allowed under the Federal Act is intended to mean. But the problem is, as a lawyer, applying this act, we are bound to go by the letter of the law, not by what the intent of the drafter is. And if I can sit before you and say, I'm not sure what this means, we're going to spend an awful long time in litigation trying to work this out. And if we're going to come up with anything like this, then what we really need to do is take a hard look at it and come up with something which is a little bit more comprehensible. This bill talks in terms of private interviews. I would only say to you that with respect to private interviews, the statute is currently clear. The agents of Oregon OSHA may have private interviews with the owner, the employer, agents, or employees. And this bill changes that. It imposes somewhat of a Miranda-type warning where we would say, well, do you want to have an interview in private or not? There's a case in point from the Court of Appeals which deals with the right of a private interview and the purpose of a private interview, which characterizes that purpose as being one of the strongest weapons in OSHA's arsenal. And something that we believe should be preserved. This doesn't completely undermine the ability to have private interviews, but it certainly changes the statutory scheme.
Just a little bit, can I interrupt briefly? You summarize your testimony and hit the high points. You've got your written testimony.
All right.
If you, and just in the context of time,
all right,
got a log sign up sheet here that we'd like to get through today. You should perhaps to summarize.
Yes. Okay, I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, I may ask a clarifying question here. Mr. Lewis, do you support the bill or not?
As it's written, it's difficult to support Representative Breyer. Because since you asked the question, and frankly, I wasn't going to bring this up. I mean, I'm just trying to testify from the standpoint of the state agency that looks at the statute and says this is what it's going to do. But frankly, as it is written, I believe that it goes a long way to reversing some of the good things that we have done in the past, to reversing some of the progress that we have made. And my fear is that if this bill, as written, is passed, more workers will be injured. Workers' comp rates will go up again. It's not good for business. It's not good for workers, and it's not good for the state of Oregon. And if you want to read the rest of my testimony, I guess you can. That pretty well sums it up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. DeLuca, I have read your written testimony, and I do appreciate that. And let me say, as clear as I've said before, I think that La Rocha has made great strides, and I've appreciated the positive, proactive approach it's taken, especially with consultation. There's no agency that exists that's perfect. We can all recognize that. And there are some concerns addressed by this bill that I would like to see us try to address. But I do understand that we're dealing with having a common goal here and how we can achieve that. The one thought, and I don't want to blindside you, so I'm going to just ask you to check this concept or concern out because it has to do with the frequency of inspections. And I'll just mention this to you and give you a chance to get back to us. That's why I just wanted to state the question early. Looking at the Internet on the federal OSHA database, it suggests that actually, although we talk about worst first in terms of the inspection process that's planned, there also appears to be a frequency of inspections related to where offices are located, OSHA offices or facilities. In other words, the convenience of the office may drive some of the inspection frequency. And so if you're really going to have to drive a long ways or you're going to have to go somewhere further afield, that frequency drops off heavily. And just looking at some of the figures, for instance, in the state and Salem area, during the past 17 years, there's a listing of 45 planned inspections. If you go to Hermiston, and you want to see how much, you have to compare the number of food processing plants and whatever else. There's a lot of other database stuff you have to look at to compare apples and apples. But there's only 5 in that area, and then in Medford there's 22 now with food processing down there. Is there, and this is a general question I'm just asking you to come back with some information on later, is there also a frequency factor that's affected by location of employees? Now, that doesn't say that's good or bad. You know, when people are located in a metro area, maybe that's just the way it is. It's harder to get to rural areas. But I'd like to see at some point if the statistics are weighted in the sense that we're seeing more inspection activity because plants happen to be located near where personnel are. And if that's the case, I'd want to know how we can wean ourselves from that. And, you know, you have to give yourself a jump start then to get further afield where folks may be sitting fat and happy, not having as many inspections as necessary. I don't expect you to answer that today, but I wanted to throw that out for you.
A quick reaction, Mr. Chairman. Representative Mannix, I think there's something to be said for what you're saying, and I don't disagree. We try to place our employees in locations where most workers are, and I'm not so certain that with the number of inspectors that we have, if we really did that completely demographically, we'd have about 75 in Portland and the rest scattered throughout the rest of the state. We do have a couple of inspectors in Pendleton, which is a far cry from the number that we have in Portland, and Portland is our biggest field office. We try to space them around the state, but I'm sure that if you look, the closer to the field office, you would find the higher number of inspections, and that's a question that I think we need to address. I don't disagree with that idea. I think the best way to address it is through direction from the administrator, through administrative rule. Frankly, I don't know that this statute in any way addresses, or this proposal in any way addresses that, but certainly it's something that we need to look at and work on.
Right. Well, I think it does try to address it in terms of work first, but there are other complications, and I recognize it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. DeLuca, after the ill-fated changes brought forward in 98 for Division I administrative rules, there was a task force that you did put together here, and wasn't what was proposed here by that task force part of this bill here when we're looking at a worst-first basis?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Walsh, that is correct. And as I said, we do not oppose the idea of worst first. In fact, in further response to Representative Dyer's question, there are two elements of this bill that, frankly, I find very attractive. One is worst first, as long as it's understood that it's not worst only. And the second element is the 180-day statute from the time that we open an inspection, because currently it's from the time that the director obtains knowledge that a violation occurs, and there's no way that you can really measure that. When does one obtain knowledge? So I think that would be very helpful as well. So there are portions of the bill even as written that we do think are a good idea, and worst first is one of them.
Is there other language? I see that they're trying to achieve that, I think, by saying that you will put the word ordinarily in there. You ordinarily prioritize inspections based on worst case, which would leave it open that you didn't have to do it all the time that way. Is there better language that would still emphasize that you would do what you said you thought was a good practice, that you would go to the worst place first, but it would certainly take you the language would make it clear if you had other options of how you could do things?
Mr. Chair, Representative Percy, I have been asked about that and have actually drafted on a couple of different occasions alternative language that I think would give OROSHA the flexibility it needs in order to accomplish all parts of its mission, while at the same time focusing our first efforts on the worst of the businesses in Oregon, the worst offenders, if you will. So, yes, there is a possibility of doing that.
Did that come up in the work group that worked on this?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kersey, I don't believe it did. But the work group you're talking about is?
I guess what I heard Representative Welch say, that this came out of parts of this came out of a group of people that had worked together and thought they had some agreement.
Actually, there have been a number of different work groups, and so it gets a little confusing. The work group that worked on this bill itself, I have provided that language to Representative Krupp and some others, and would be happy to provide it to anyone who wants it.
Thank you. Thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you very much. Mr. Witt, briefly, if possible.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, I'm Brad Witt, Secretary-Treasurer of the Oregon AFL-CIO, appearing before you this evening in opposition to House Bill 2830. We have appreciated the efforts by all the parties of interest in this bill to get together and attempt to craft something that was equitable and of interest and beneficial to everyone. Unfortunately, that hasn't occurred, and because of that, we are opposing this bill for two main reasons. One, it would counteract random OSHA inspections, and secondly, it would maintain significant loopholes that we believe would seriously undermine OSHA's effectiveness. And with respect to the OSHA inspections, as Mr. DeLuca has already pointed out, this would limit random inspections to high incidence rates governed by SIC codes, so that if you have a high hazard industry, acknowledged high hazard, that's why they call it high hazard, your incidence rate would have to be at or above the national average, which means that the half that's below that is not even subject to those kinds of inspections, and we think that that is absolutely a terrible, terrible mistake. It would also, the bill would also enable creative folks, I think, to avoid surprise inspections simply by employers not having their attorneys on premise. The bill gives an absolute right for employers to be represented by an attorney during inspections, and presuming that attorney may be in Seattle or Boise or Chicago or wherever, the bill says that there ought not to be unreasonable delay, but whatever time it took for that attorney to get on site to premise to represent the employer may not be unreasonable. But we believe that it would seriously limit or negate, actually, any or all surprise inspections. Mr. DeLuca has already discussed with you the issue of private inspections. I would only add that if it's changed now from a situation where everyone is privately interviewed to how many of you want the private interview, it becomes relatively easy through the process of elimination to determine who it is that may be having information to be giving to Oregon OSHA. And then it's a question of whether or not retaliation results from that. And we would certainly be advocates of eliminating that possibility. Lastly, the bill contains a loophole where anyone can represent the folks in the walk-around portion of an OSHA inspection. And presumably anyone includes management representing the workers or representing the unions, and certainly that has the appearance, face value, if nothing less, of being a decided a conflict of interest, and we would oppose the bill on that basis. Last but not least, Mr. DeLuca also mentioned the accomplishments that have been made in the state with workers' comp reform. OSHA being the flip side of that and as part of that reform effort, going, as Mr. DeLuca said, from the fourth in the nation to the 38th. Depending upon what source you take a look at, we have figures in the neighborhood of savings of $3.5 billion, I think, is a figure to employers in the state of Oregon. That is a very, very significant figure. Back several years ago, when the Workers' Comp Research Institute first analyzed the reasons for Oregon's, what they called Oregon's miracle, the reasons for the savings that were being realized by employers in the state, they attributed up to one-third of those savings to increased OSHA enforcement in this state. I suggest to you that on that basis, safety and health pays. It pays because workers are injured and employers are saving money. This bill is headed in the wrong direction. And because of that and the several unworkable reasons that I've already discussed, would urge you to reject this bill as currently written.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Mr. Wendt? Thank you both very much for your testimony today.
Thank you.
We'd like Mr. Richter, Mr. Stallnacker, and Mr. Miller, Joe Miller, come forward. If you could briefly specify, summarize, abbreviate, we appreciate that.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Gary Richter. I'm risk manager for North Clackamas School District, and I'm very much in support of this bill. I'm going to be very brief compared to what I've handed out. It's great nighttime reading. It's guaranteed to put you to sleep if you'd like to read my whole story there. But we've had two particularly ugly experiences with OSHA, and in particular with the regulation and enforcement side of OSHA. We had very good experience with the consultative side. In fact, after I heard your first witness, I was tempted to label myself as John Doe, because we still have a disagreement going with Oregon OSHA. Basically, we're the sixth largest school district in Oregon. We have over 1,400 employees. And we range of all types of workers, from teachers to tradesmen to bus drivers, mechanics, custodians, you name it, we have it. We also are self-insured. We have a very good record. I have personally taken advantage of the OSHA consulting services numerous occasions and have found them to be very helpful. In fact, the portion of this bill that I appreciate the most is that notice would possibly be given out to those folks who would get an inspection. We would have the opportunity, perhaps, to take advantage of the consultative services. What happens at this point is that an investigator descends upon your company. Everything that takes place, you're presumed guilty until you prove yourself innocent. And what becomes what should be a very simple process becomes very convoluted. Basically, we've had two visits at the same high school by Oregon OSHA in the last 5 years. I might point out, we have 19 elementary schools, 4 middle schools, 3 high schools, Owen Saban Occupational Skill Center, Working Farm, a physical plant department, and a transportation department. We have other places. They've come to this one high school on two different occasions. The first one was for good reason, because there was a mix-up in paperwork. Our transportation department and our high school have the same street address, so it looks like we were having a great deal of accidents for our school site. And then we hopefully have corrected that now. They came back this, the first time, though, in 94. We had citations in the amount of $1,440. Now, that may not seem like a whole lot for a larger industry, as we probably are in Oregon, but we recognize that the tax dollars fund schools, and we don't like to waste them. The biggest problem, especially when we don't have the opportunity to take advantage of consultative, of a good look over before they come to inspect us, is that most of these things are very simple little items that could be taken care of in a very simple fashion. Indeed, when we were first inspected in 94, we took care of all the items within approximately 15 days of being told about them. We still have $1,440 worth of fines to deal with, and OSHA does not like to give up their fines. They like you to pay, and in fact, it is my personal opinion as an employer representative that the enforcement side is revenue-driven, that they are not safety-driven. And I would take great task, because we have a good safety record, basically, but they don't want to give up those fines. In this past time, we've received $1,750 worth of fines, largely because I denied the inspector access, and they came back with a vengeance. They descended on our school with two inspectors. I spent a minimum of 15 hours dealing with these two inspectors personally, and they virtually put us under a microscope. Out of those violations, when I asked for an automatic extension of time, it was refused. I might point out that six violations that were classified as other. Other violations mean that there is no immediate hazard to any person. And there's no reason, 47 states would ordinarily grant extensions without any question at all. Oregon does not do that. I got a letter back from Portland, the Portland office of OSHA, saying that they wouldn't grant us any extensions. Our only option was to either close the place up or abate everything, which would cost us approximately $5,000 to $6,000. Now, that's not a good option, so I retained the services of an attorney, and interestingly enough, the attorney made one phone call and Oregon OSHA completely changed their position. They are granting us an extension on everything until we can talk about it in an informal conference. What concerns me the most as a public entity is that we can't even get cooperation from another public entity without the intervention of an attorney. Now, with all deference to some of you folks who may be attorneys, that I think that's insulting. We should be working with these folks, particularly as one public entity to another, and instead, it is always an adversarial relationship. For those reasons alone, I would really encourage you to pass the House bill and the amendments to it.
You said you had six violations that were other than immediate hazard violations, and you had some that were immediate hazard violations?
I had $900 worth of violations for custodial closet, where they plug in a floor sweeper, and the fellow adds water to the battery. So they figured out ways to give me three violations for one custodial closet. We're disputing every single thing they came up with.
And you're talking about cooperation between them. Denying an inspector access, is that cooperation?
The inspector showed up at lunchtime during spring break. There were no administrators at this particular high school. There were no supervisors of any sort. I was called out of a lunchtime meeting to talk with him on the phone, and I told him the obvious problems. He said, well, we can't come back. We have to do it right now. And I said, well, under those circumstances, I can't accommodate you. Also, I did not believe that they had cause to go through our facility, because we have a very good safety record. Under those circumstances, I did refuse them access. Also, I wasn't available to go over there. There was no one available to go through it with him. And there's no one to answer the questions other than me. I got back to my office, and I had second thoughts about it because I thought, uh-oh, I'm making a big bad enemy out of these folks. I called this inspector up, and I left a voicemail for him saying that I'd be happy to meet with him at any time of his choosing. After getting the warrant, he told me that he never heard or got the voicemail, which I found very hard to accept.
You're talking about also about a good look over before they have an inspection, you know, about the consultative services. Those consultative services are available to you any day currently under current law, right?
Yes, sir. I have used them on numerous occasions. Excuse me.
Seven or eight.
No.
Thank you. Mr. Coleman.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Ray Stalnaker. I'm safety manager for St. Vincent de Paul Rehabilitation Service in Portland. And thank you very much for the opportunity to give testimony in favor of House Bill 2830. Just briefly to let you know where I'm coming from on this bill, tell you a little bit about who I am. I've been in occupational safety and health for 24 years, 11 years with Lumberman's Underwriting Alliance as a loss prevention engineer, 7 years as corporate safety director for Croman Corporation with sawmilling in Ashland and Boise, Idaho, and helicopter logging operations in 5 western states. I then went on to be a safety and health consultant with my own business for 2.5 years. Over the last 3.5 years, I've been safety manager for St. Vincent de Paul. Now, in those 24 years, I've undergone lost count. I think it's 43 OSHA inspections. And so I'm quite a veteran there. I've been inspected by Federal OSHA over in Idaho, Cal OSHA in California, WSHA in Washington, and of those 43 OSHA inspections, probably around 34, 35 of them were for OSHA inspections with our Oregon activities. And what I've experienced is a mixed bag. There are very good compliance officers out there, and at the same time, regardless of which OSHA entity you're talking about, there are very poor compliance officers to boot. And I would be willing to bet that the majority of people who are deathly afraid of the OSHA entities are the people who have undergone those inspections by very poor compliance officers. Just as an example, last week when you were accepting testimony, You heard from a Mrs. King in Florence, Oregon, and she referred to Oregon OSHA and Gestapo several times in the same sentence. And I find that that is not very uncommon with Oregon employers. One of the, Oregon OSHA has made good inroads under Mr. DeLuca in the recent past. We need to keep the ball rolling. One of the big problems, like I've just pointed out, are inspections, and especially inspections by the poor compliance officers. But certain specifics that this bill would do, number one, it wouldn't focus on the businesses where there weren't problems. If you're going to do inspections, the worst first is the way to go. They should not be focusing their efforts in areas where there are problems. The next area is private interviews with employees. One of the worst scenarios with any OSHA inspection is when the compliance officer takes aside the employees privately, and citations result from the contents of those little private interviews. Quite commonly, the compliance officer will utilize jargon and it's not understood by the employee, and an incorrect answer would come about and a citation would result. In my experience, it is very, very rare that any employee wants to be alone in that room with a compliance officer. They would much prefer to have the representative of the employer with them at the meeting. Now, one of the things that this bill does do is give the employee the option of asking for the private interview rather than have the employer representative come in during the interview. Okay. The next, the employer does need does need an option to have an attorney present during the inspection. It keeps the compliance officers in line, keeps the employer in line. And a reasonable accommodation, I don't think, is too much to ask. Most Oregon employers aren't large enough to have someone like myself on staff, a safety manager, a safety director, whatever, that can accompany the compliance officers during their inspections. Those people should definitely have the right to call at least an attorney who they would feel comfortable with. A four-hour delay, I don't believe, is unreasonable. Okay, the the employees desiring to have their own representative, I think, is very rare in small business. It's very common in your large businesses and where you have unions. But it seems to me unreasonable for a small business to receive an inspection and the employees really don't care if they have representation, and actually prefer that they don't, to have to come up with some sort of a representative to go through. Some of your small businesses may as well shut down, if that were the case anyway, that they would have to elect someone to go through on the inspection with them, or maybe take a key person away from their job duties while the inspection was going on because they couldn't operate while they were providing that representation for the employees. Finally, the last thing I'd like to give testimony on is this bill would seem to limit citations or violations, citable violations, to those to which the employee was exposed to. Okay? It was an actual unsafe condition that an employee was exposed to and the employer knew or should have known of that condition. Too often there are citations made of violations where no one was exposed to an unsafe condition. During the course of an inspection, maybe a guardrail was down. Someone had neglected to put it back up. There was no one in the area at all. The employer had no way of knowing that it wasn't down until they made the walk-through inspection. There it is, down. There's a citation. And it causes a lot of ill feelings among employers. And you find things in litigation all the time because of this. I apologize. I don't have written testimony to hand out in front of everybody. My time constraints with my job didn't allow me to type something up. But I'm open to any questions you might have.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee? Thank you very much. Mr. Miller, would you please proceed?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Joe Miller, Safety and Loss Control Manager for the Oregon Columbia Chapter of the Associated General Contractors. AGC represents 1,200 open and union shop commercial construction contractors in the state of Oregon. AGC members include all facets of the construction industry, including general contractors, subcontractors, material and equipment suppliers. Prior to my employment with AGC about 3 years ago, I worked 21 years for Oregon OSHA, of which the last 5 years was as manager of their enforcement program. So I do have a bit of insight into the regulatory end of that organization and have a perspective perhaps that's a bit unique. Thank you for the opportunity to talk to you today in support of the Dash 5 amendments to House Bill 2830. Since the Federal Occupational Safety and Health Act and ORS 654 were initially enacted over 25 years ago, extensive litigation has resulted in court decisions that serve to clarify issues that were not well-defined in the initial legislation. AGC feels that the proposed amendments in House Bill 2830 would codify into statutes decisions and procedures that have been established in that process and tend to limit future litigation. There are some specific areas I would give general comment on. I do have written testimony before you in the area of scheduling inspections based on a worst first priority. OSHA has a limited resource and cannot inspect every place of employment. So what is the best use of their time? Is there a factor that says, well, if we have this threat hanging out there over every employer of the state that we can come in at any time, that means that all of those employers are going to fear us and we're going to be better because sometime Oregon OSHA might come in? Or on the other side of it, if or OSHA develops a list of people that are having problems through their history, and they publish that list so that those people know that there's potential for inspection, wouldn't they then want to work to improve their workplace so they're no longer on that list and no longer subject to inspection? So I don't see that the potential to be inspected is a great incentive as compared to being notified by Oregon OSHA that there is a very high potential of being inspected. Private interviews. I believe the current law gives employees the opportunity to check representatives, not only employees, but employers. Gives them opportunities to approve of who their representative should be. I feel that there are employees who are very uncomfortable in interviews with OSHA investigators or inspectors that would like to have someone of their choosing to sit in with them. If they have that choice and make that choice, that doesn't limit anyone's rights. I think those are the general comments that I would make, other than what I have specifically in my written testimony.
Thank you. Any questions?
You're saying that employees would feel more comfortable if they had a representative of their choice. Don't you feel that they'd feel equally uncomfortable having an employer representative in there talking about conditions on the job?
As I understand, the language is their choice.
And wouldn't you feel that employers would be telling their employees when an OSHA inspection comes about that they'd like to have an employer representative in the room with them?
That may occur. I'm not sure. I don't think that that's a factor that is would outweigh the option of employees having their own choice.
You're talking about, just to continue, Mr. Chair, you're talking also about the change, having the inspection, the random inspection, hanging over your head. As one who's worked in the construction trades for over 20 years, I've seen in the last 10 years a radical change in attitude on construction sites where contractors I would work for 20 years ago would have had a normal attitude of, go ahead and stand on the top step of a 6-foot ladder or an 8-foot ladder. Their attitude has dramatically changed over a period of years to get the adequate size ladder and to make sure that those near misses, those dangerous steps are not taken. And a lot of that's due to the attitude change because of OSHA and because of their inspection and knowing the random inspection. You don't feel that at all be reversed in any way, shape, or form if they know they don't have a random inspection hanging over them.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gardner, in construction is unique. They have never been scheduled in the past, which I believe has been a problem.
Mm-hmm.
But OSHA has opportunity to inspect based on imminent danger, what they see as they drive by, and I believe that's how they schedule a lot of their inspections currently. There's complaints. There's a lot of avenues for OSHA to schedule construction inspectors other than just through a schedule list. And I believe a great change has occurred in construction, as in all places of employment in the state of Oregon. And I would give Oregon OSHA and their program credit for that, as well as attitudes of employers, attitudes of insurance carriers. Currently a consultant for construction employers right now, and I believe that there's been a cultural shift in this state over the past, 10 years. I've been in this business, practically 25 years now, and I've seen a major shift in employers' attitudes, partly because of Oregon OSHA and partly because of other factors. So I don't think that in construction employers are out there complying with rules principally because of Oregon OSHA. I think they understand it's good business to do that.
Representative Pearson.
Thank you.
And we'll move on to our next panel.
I'm just listening to all this, and what I have heard is that we have been doing a very, very good job in this state, and so I want to express some concern that if we've been doing a very good job, why it is we want to make any significant change. And what I'm hearing from you is that I guess I'm hearing that you think there's in some cases too many inspections. No?
No, I don't think I don't think there's too many inspections.
Okay. It was intimated that they're showing up a lot compared to other states. I think I heard something like that. And the other thing is that there's some concerns about the attitudes that the OSHA people are coming in with. And so it seems to me that's more of a personnel issue than a doing how you do business kind of issue. There might be some other avenues that would be open to you to have a discussion if you were having some personality or personnel difficulties that wouldn't go so far as to have to remake this what we're doing in order to address those.
Mr. Chair, Representative Piercy, I don't believe these are major changes to the Oregon Safe Employment Act. They may be portrayed as such by some, but
again, 25 years since the initial legislation, with no substantive changes to the Oregon Safe Employment Act. There have been some things added, but procedurally, no substantive changes to the Oregon Safe Employment Act. 25 years of history of court cases where agencies were directed to put procedures together to respond to problems that the court felt. This, I believe, would correct some of those things that have had to have been corrected through court decisions. I don't believe there are major changes. I don't believe it would affect OROSHA's effectiveness, and I don't believe it would limit the rights of anyone under the Oregon Safe Employment Act.
Thank you very much, and move on to the next one. Mr. Shiprack, Ms. Smith, and Mr. Peppers, would you all three come forward? And I've been asked by members of the committee for our continuing witnesses that brevity and succinctness will be appreciated, and and it actually maybe more swing than the length of your argument.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association, a union of classified school employees throughout the state in K-12 community colleges, parks and rec districts, and ESDs, and I'm here in opposition to House Bill 2830 for many of the reasons that the other opponents that you have heard from today have outlined very eloquently for you, and I will be succinct enough not to repeat those with a couple of exceptions. Those exceptions and the things that I want to concentrate my testimony on deal with Section 3 and Section 5 of the bill, which change the way employees are interviewed by OSHA. Currently under the law, an employee that is interviewed during the course of an inspection or an investigation is interviewed privately by Oregon OSHA investigators. This law changes that to say that they may be interviewed privately if they choose to be interviewed privately. The way this will work in a workplace is, first of all, let me say that I believe in that it has been the longstanding policy of the state that it is important to have a regulatory agency in place, Oregon OSHA, that operates in a balanced, fair way to assure that workplaces throughout the state, all workplaces, are safe. And the purpose of that is obviously to protect workers, but also to protect businesses from the ramifications of injuries and deaths occurring in those workplaces. When Oregon OSHA comes into a workplace, it's often a difficult experience for employees and employers, and employees need the confidence to know that when they speak to an Oregon OSHA inspector, they may do so freely and honestly and give full information and not worry about retaliation from their employer. The change in the law that will occur with this bill will cause some opportunity for intimidation and retaliation, because the mere request that would have to be made by an employee for a private interview will cause a focus by the employer on that employee. Why do you need a private interview? Aren't we all out in the open here? Aren't we all on the same side? Why do you need to meet with OSHA privately? The current law exists and works very well, and there is no need for change in Section 3 or Section 5 that would allow an employer or an employer's representative to be present during those investigations and interviews, or to force an employee to request a private interview. So with that, I will let my colleagues tell you what else is wrong with the bill.
Okay. For the record, Rich Peppers with the Oregon Public Employees Union, and also appearing in opposition to 2830. I just want to pick up on a couple of comments that were made earlier. To us and to many other labor organizations, these changes, as opposed to what you heard earlier, are viewed as very significant, and they would damage our occupational safety and health system. I'm going to just restate real quickly that we believe the portions of the bill that would undermine the ability to do random inspections are difficult, sections 1 and 2. We believe that there should be an emphasis on worst first, but doing it to the exclusion of the ability to do random inspections is very problematic. We think the piece that you just heard Tricia Smith speak about is very significant. Whistleblower protections are critical. He's essentially undermined them. We also think that there is a problem with the bill in the sense that, well, actually I wanted to point out that one of the problems that was pointed out by somebody else, I think, is already addressing current language and the ability to have some alternative if the employees don't have their own representatives selected or a way of selecting them. If you look at page 3, lines 3 through 8, they identify under current language already a system for employees or for the directors to respond in a situation when during an inspection the employees don't have their own representatives selected. And that we believe that system works and is sufficient and does not need to be altered. Leave you with the final point and real important concern to us is that the whole system is set up to avoid the very first injury and to sometimes be perhaps viewed as overly thorough, but by going in and making sure that employers feel obligated to not just react after an injury has occurred, but to be responsible for safety in the workplace before an injury has occurred is the whole purpose of this statute.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman. Bob Shiprock, Oregon Building and Construction Trades Council. I'll be brief as well. Just a few points that might not have been touched on. I'd point out to this committee that in May of 1990, this legislature came together in a special session for 2 days to pass sweeping reforms of the OSHA establishment. So to hear testimony that nothing's been done for a long time is inaccurate. Have you take a look at the changes that were made in those at that time. I was wondering why the lawyers were in the room, and then I found out the bill says they have to be present and, or could be present during inspection. So that's some good time for some billable hours there. Not saying any more about that.
That's why is a problem.
I can't afford them. One of the problems we have in construction is that you do this worst-first concept that doesn't work for multi-employer work sites. You could have a general contractor who has a great safety record for their employees. If there's 15 to 20 subcontractors on that job site, perhaps some of the time we don't even know who they are. And so it's really important that the inspectors have access to those sites on a random basis because the employer listed, the general contractor, has maybe very few of the actual workers on the job site. You can have people doing some bad things. Kind of resents the fact that employer representatives tell us that employees really don't care about safety and won't speak up or anything, and I just assume that people like the people in Bernie would speak for the workers on that issue. This really was a deal between labor and management to enhance safety. I asked the committee to take a look at the statistics. Just get the statistics on the declines in deaths and injuries in this state in the last 10 or 12 years. Just look at the facts. This bill is a real step backward in those efforts. I won't even talk about all the money that's been saved and the rates that have gone down. I also don't think you should codify OSHA's actions, their responsibilities too strictly, but instead let labor and management work with them because, as we've seen in the last decade and a half, 2 decades, Oregon's workforce has dramatically changed and workplace is changing. OSHA has to keep up with that in the changing industries. The last thing I'll just say is that I checked with Pete. He wasn't sure. We can get these statistics, but you can't imagine OSHA inspectors calling over every workplace. His recollection, and it's pretty close to mine, is that we inspected every Oregon workplace, they'd be inspected once every 17 years. So we don't have some kind of a police force out there. You're doing a good job.
Yes. Mr. Chair, I'd like to add Tricia Smith again for the record. There was one other point that was made in earlier testimony that I would like to clarify. One of the earlier speakers indicated to you that OSHA is very attached to their fines and unwilling to mitigate fines because they want the money. I wanted to clarify for the committee that fines coming to Oregon OSHA go into the Worker Benefit Fund and are not checked by the agency.
A lot of comments about that not only employers but employees might want to change this privacy conversation piece, and I just wanted to ask you if any of you have heard from employees that they want to change the current practice of being able to speak in private about their concerns about their workplace, if they feel that puts too much, puts them in a bad position, or in some way they don't, there's something about that doesn't work for them.
Well, we have not.
No, we have not either. In fact, the opposite is true. They feel that to change it to require the employee to request a private interview would put pressure on them that does not currently exist.
I've not heard that comment either. Frankly, we'd like to have more conversations with these people.
Thank you. Question I have is, under current law, during the interview process, can an employee request someone else be present with them, whether that's management, an employer, or maybe a union official? Is that possible?
Yes. Any additional questions? Representative Walsh.
I've been through two inspections myself as a plant manager and someone who's been involved in the industry for a long time. I take this piece of legislation very seriously. And I guess something that's left out here has not been stated. And I'll just ask it as a question to Bob, who I have a lot of respect for here. Isn't it also someone that's representing the employees, an employer very concerned about their employees and their safety, and the concern that there is a possibility of an inspection, but yet, even if they're going to take the worst first, still the fact is that we pay for those accidents, or the employer does, or owner does. And it doesn't take an agency, a heavy-handed regulation. I'm not calling OSHA heavy-handed. We've gone through inspections, done very well, although there were fines. But it is expensive if you start running high level of incidents. It's very expensive. We have to pay those insurance rates, and when we have so many of them, they hit different categories, it takes you forever to back out of that. And that in itself really regulates what you should be thinking about as an owner or manager. So we take very seriously safety, and we've gotten more stringent with that. In fact, there's people that lose their jobs when they cannot get it in their mind. They have to be safe. They've got to consider their own safety and others around them. That's something that hasn't come up in this discussion that I want to include here. It's not just OSHA and what they've done, or our regulation, what we've done to state. But I think if they were to be an advocate, certainly, and be able to come in and do a walkthrough with you, there's so many things that you can learn, and what they will be looking for when they come in on an inspection. And we invite private people to do that. Just before I left for up here, I said, you get an inspection now because we have no construction happening. I said, you have got to understand what's going to be safe for these people and contractors and subcontractors coming in. But, you know, I just want to mention that. And isn't that true, Bob?
That's good.
It's a bottom line for our company. I don't care. And you're
situation, certainly for a heavy subcontractor, is different than ours, having a facility manufacturing in place all the time. The only time we really have to be on our toes is when we bring subcontractors in, and that really brings our awareness level up much higher.
It should. Very briefly, Mr. Chairman, the representative is absolutely correct. If you were to ask employers in a lot of even hazardous industries 15 years ago what their mod rate was, which is the experience modification factor, which is what gauges what they pay in workers' comp insurance, they wouldn't have known what you're talking about. They weren't even putting a relationship between incidents and costs. And that has changed dramatically. And it has affected our industry tremendously, and that a lot of owners on the private side oftentimes now won't even allow our contractors to bid a job if their mod rate is over one, which is the industry average. And so we're very cautious of it.
Any additional questions from the panel? Hearing none. Thank you very much. Final panelists, Mr. Stouffer, Ms. Dougherty. If I could repeat the request of the committee, brevity is appreciated. Stouffer?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Matt Stouffer. I'm an insurance agent in Springfield, Oregon. I sell work comp insurance for a living. My background is in loss prevention with the insurance carriers and 7 years industry experience prior to that. I prepared testimony that I emailed you, and I sent an attachment of the testimony I provided to the Division I hearings in Bend last week. That was sent to you last Monday, and I'll refer to that for any of the specific stuff. Anecdotally, I wanted to share a lot of things with you, but I think probably the best use of my time with you is targeting the two issues you brought up. Representative Piercy, you talked a little bit earlier about the inspection scheduling subcommittee. For those of you that are aware of the Division I changes that came about last year, initiated a pretty sweeping involvement with some stakeholder groups, I became involved in the inspection scheduling subcommittee, and my adamant support of HB 2830 comes out of my dissatisfaction with the way that we were handled and the way that we were worked with in the inspection scheduling subcommittee in particular. So hopefully I can answer some questions for you, which I don't think were addressed earlier in regard to that. It's interesting when you come up with the comments earlier made about the mode that OSHA takes and the role that they play in their interaction with business in general. I think I would make a case, and I would use Mr. DeLuca's own comments made earlier with regard to private inspections, where he stated the removal of the private interviews would characterize, or he characterized private interviews as the strongest weapon in an arsenal. And weapons are used in war with two opposing sides. And I have experienced on many occasions with employers that there is an adversarial role taken from the moment an inspector enters the workplace. I think that employees in general are disillusioned when they believe that interviews that are conducted with them are private. Private does not equal confidential. At the moment that an inspection happens and the employee is interviewed privately, ultimately the results of that interview, unless very specifically requested otherwise, become part of the public record and are used as the employer, hopefully, prepares a defense on those issues. So, and anecdotally, I'll share one specific case that I'm very familiar with an employer client of mine, that had employees, both Hispanic and English speaking. I got there when the inspector came to do an inspection of an accident, and when we were queried as to who was the employee representative, the employee representative initially chosen was an English speaking secretary from the office. At my urging, they chose a plant superintendent who was bilingual. These are the kind of things that I don't think employers know that they can ask for and that they can initiate, coordinate in the process and the inspection. I'm not an attorney. Sometimes I wish I was an attorney in order to help customers deal with the circumstance. I wouldn't be ashamed of that. But in this case, this person was very instrumental in helping those other employees understand what was being said and what was being asked of them by the inspection, by the inspector. In this case also, one other employee was interviewed privately. The private interview was tape recorded. We asked for a copy of the tape recording in preparation for the appeal. The employee, by their own account, indicated that the inspector had become quite belligerent and implied that if they weren't willing to answer questions, that they would invite the sheriff in to compel them to answer. Interestingly, when we received the tape recording, that section of the interview was accelerated 4 times. We took it to an audio engineer who backed it off and found out that at that moment in time, the inspector said, "I'm going to turn off the tape now." Turned it off, and then at that time, the problem ensued with the employee. The employee was very emphatic, quite upset about it, this is the kind of experience that I think was shared by others. And unfortunately, it's not representative of the whole of the way OSHA does business. I would say that the vast majority of inspections are conducted very professionally. But the fact that this bill sits before you as something comes out of the despair that employers incur when they go through these kinds of experiences, and the dismay that we found as an inspection scheduling subcommittee, and I will speak for myself in that regard, with the way that our proposed rules were put forward and then changed through the involvement of the Partnership Council or Partnership Committee, to which we were never informed would be involved in that stakeholder process. And I'm going to leave it at that. I think that we've addressed the issues that you've had as an employer. As a broker on the work comp side, I concur with most of what everybody has said with regards to the rates of drop. I think rates have dropped precipitously because of a lot of factors, OSHA included. And that's an issue that employers take very seriously, the dollars and cents, and the life and limb is equally important. I think that the adversarial stance that OSHA takes undermines the reality that employers do not have their employees in their crosshairs. They have them in their best interest.
Thank you. Mr. Crowley, and then there's a question.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Brian Doherty of the law firm Miller Nash. I am the attorney that they've been looking for back in the back room. And unlike Mr. Shickrack, though, I've been foolish enough not to get paid at all for what I'm doing here today. So I am representing, in my...
Mr. Doherty, if I can interrupt you for a moment. I'm sorry to mispronounce your name, but I did want to let the committee know that Representative Kepp has requested to come to the committee and testify, so we will have one more witness after this. Please proceed.
Thank you. In my private practice or in my law practice outside of Salem, one of my areas of emphasis is OSHA inspections and representing employers and inspections and appeals. And I want to draw from a few things that Mr. Shipwreck said, as I think are very relevant to why this bill is here and not why this bill shouldn't be here. Number one is there are many factors that have brought us to the point we are in terms of the loss ratio that's in Oregon and the decreased injury rate. OSHA is but one. And in that agreement that Mr. Shipwreck was involved in, they did many things. One of the greatest things I think we did is we mandated safety committees in Oregon, which is not mandated by federal law. That is a significant thing in getting employee buy-in into safety in the workplace. We also made dramatic changes in workers' compensation that reduced rates by simply eliminating almost a third of the claims that were in workers' compensation beforehand. You can't take credit for that from Oregon OSHA. The other thing we have is just what Mr. Shipwreck said, that we have now a much more employer awareness that this is a bottom-line issue. 15 years ago, they wouldn't have known what a mod rate is now. Now, this thing is bottom-line buy-in from the top president on down. When you talk to these employers, they know it's a bottom-line issue. That's not Oregon OSHA. Oregon OSHA has done a good job. We beefed up that agency, and we came here with a much better record. But Representative Piercy asked the question, why fix it if it's broke? Why did the Division I rules come in and be proposed by Oregon OSHA to be changed if everything's perfect and we don't need to fix anything? The Division I rules were sweeping changes that were in there. They are now been abandoned. We go into work groups. If we're doing just great, why was OSHA proposing changes to those Division I rules? Now let's get to a couple of the comments that were made. And I'd be glad to stop for the trip. If you'd like to please proceed.
I'm enjoying
it. One of the things that I think we ask is, why are we here today with some of these changes? They're born of litigation issues. They're born of issues that are occurring, not new in Oregon. We now have the Maine 2000 plan, which did just this, worst first. And I want to correct it. This is not worst only. This is worst first. They've done it in Maine and had success. The federal government right now, in August of 1998, published a rule on inspections that's dealing with a worst first program. The movement is going on. This is not a static system. They're trying to get better. We say we go from 4th to 38th. We can do better in Oregon. When you hear yourself say that we only can do 6% of the Oregon employers in inspections a year by Oregon OSHA, that's 94% of the people that aren't going to be inspected anyway. How do you use that limited resource? And we have a large OSHA inspection staff. I think this puts the resources where they should be, is emphasizing worst first, notifying them that you're coming, that we may be coming, and that you can use consultative services that might help you, because you are in a high-risk industry. You are a high-risk employer individually, because we have the data from the lost workday case incident rate, or the MOD rate, and we know who you are. We're going to help you, but we're also more likely to be seeing you if you don't shape up. What a wonderful thing would happen if all of a sudden consultative services was so busy they needed more help, because that gets the people that are making those phone calls are the people that are causing the injury to employees. Now, we get back to this idea about worst only, and I don't believe that's what this says, and I believe that's what the word ordinarily should be interpreted as, an ability to have the OSHA administrator, not a field inspector, make changes. Having the OSHA inspector say after lunch, I didn't see that building, I want to walk down there and inspect it, I don't think is an appropriate means. It ought to be something that's clear. What do we want to get out of this? A focus of OSHA, a clarity to every employer as to why OSHA is coming to see them. And it can be random. I think ordinarily can mean that if the OSHA inspector wants to put other people outside of this list on a random inspection list, but that is coming from Salem, not from an individual inspector, then you can have a random inspection list against any employer. What we want to have is a prioritization. We can only get 6% of these employers. Why wouldn't we want to focus this? Why wouldn't every employee, as well as employer, want that to be the focus? If you go on to the other language in this, we have the issue about employee interviews. There is currently an injunction in Oregon right now that is telling OSHA you can't interpret this law the way you have been, which has been, it is OSHA's right. And this is, I've heard it in inspections, I've heard it talking to inspectors. It's our right as OSHA to interview employees individually. And the court said in the injunction, I believe the wording was, it is the employee's right to choose. It is not the employer's, and it's not OSHA's. That's what was trying to get from that language. So we wouldn't have this argument occur. And we have now an employee, it sounds from some of the witnesses, that the idea was that an employee is going to be intimidated from talking and wanting to discuss anything with OSHA. They can call OSHA and make a complaint anytime. It is a violation of law for an employer to retaliate against an employee for doing that. Number two, the way it happens is OSHA goes into an inspection and then says, I want to talk to these witnesses. Those witnesses would then go in private, and all we ask is that OSHA say to them, do you wish to talk to us privately, or do you wish to have a representative? That's it. This flipping of the whole system, I don't understand. I think it's only common. It is not the employer's right or OSHA's, it's the employee's right. We're dealing with inspections on fatalities that have criminal consequences. They can have criminal consequences. I think it's only right. I'm going to finish up with my last comment, directed Mr. Shipwreck's comments about attorneys, because I would just one more time to emphasize the last portion that talks about having attorneys as part of the inspection in the Section 5. It's interesting. If you had IRS knocking on your door and saying, I want to come in and inspect all your IRS records in your house, and by the way, what I'm doing, you can't have any representation, you can't have an attorney, why would that make sense to you? Why in the world, when you have inspections that can lead to criminal penalties and criminal indictments, you wouldn't be entitled to have a representative of your choice as an employer? You have it as the employee during an interview. Why not as an employer? It can't be unreasonably delayed, just like anybody else. And I think it's a rare occasion when the employer is asking for an attorney during the walk around or others. But I don't see why in the world you would limit them to have a representative of their choice, just like they let the employee. With that, I'd be glad to answer questions. Or let Representative Krupp. I'm good, sorry.
First, any questions for Mr. Hill, for Mr. Gardner? Hearing none, thank you both for your testimony, and now we'll go to Representative Krupp.
Don't leave me. Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's a pleasure to be here, and I very much apologize that I was not here sooner.
If I might. Representative Krupp, we've heard a great deal of testimony strongly in favor. We've heard a great deal of testimony strongly opposed. So.
Thank you. I just wanted to share with you briefly on the Dash 5 amendment.
I forgot the brevity line. Oh, I didn't give the brevity line to you. So.
You said, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, my reputation precedes me on all levels.
I will try to, even as Vice Chair, I'll try to maintain some decorum here, so please proceed, and if the members of the committee could please restrain themselves.
For the record, my name is State Representative Jeff Krupp, from District 37, and I just wanted to share with you briefly about the Dash 5 amendment. When I was before you last week or so, I gave you my word that I wanted to add some additional language in here that clarified that any person being interviewed would be informed of their rights in private. And that was not in the Dash 3s or the Dash 4s, and it is now in the Dash 5s. It's something very important to me. I gave the union representatives my word that I would do that, and they're still uncomfortable with that, and I certainly understand their concern there. But it was something I wanted to be sure that was in there, because that's my word, and keeping it is very important. I really cannot add a great deal more other than to say again that the purpose and the intent of this legislation is again to make certain in the statute that OSHA is moving in a direction that we believe is going to be ultimately beneficial to keeping workers from being injured on the job. And that is offering consulting services first before anything else. And we hope that that's the direction they will continue to go as they are. And I want to compliment Director DeLuca. I want to compliment the various people that have taken the time to meet with us, from union members to employer groups who have been part of this work group and have a great deal to say about this. I want to thank them for giving me their concerns. I've tried to incorporate them, and I mean that sincerely. I may or may not have reached everyone's satisfaction, as we've heard obviously here. I will continue to work, if necessary, in any direction to make the bill better. I have had extensive conversations with Senator Durfler. He is awaiting the bill on the Senate side, and if we need to continue working it over there, we certainly will. And with that, I want to thank you for staying so late and for giving us favorable consideration of this legislation.
Any substantive questions for Representative Krupp? Hearing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
With that, we'll close the hearing. Having no other business before the committee, we'll close the committee.